Czech have been sentenced for this heinous crime against this vulnerable little four-year-old boy. Daniel Pelka had the ultimate trust breached by his mother and her partner.
The United States has issued a worldwide travel alert warning citizens about potential terrorist attacks. The State Department says information suggests Al-Qaeda may carry out an attack in August, most likely in the Middle East and North Africa. The Omar office has issued a statement insisting officers aren't allowed to approach people based simply on race or appearance. It's after stop and search tactics at London train stations were criticised for targeting non-white people. A man's been charged with murder after a model was stabbed to death in London. Lena Kazar, who was 29, was attacked at her home in Leighton on Wednesday. A study estimates 26 million of us are living on the edge and struggling to make ends meet. Research by the Money Advice Service found around 9 million more adults find it difficult to pay bills compared to 7 years ago. These people in Coventry admit it can be tough.
Bills and things, just general day-to-day, really, but we have to be optimistic that things will get better. We have to be.
Very hard to save now, especially you got a kid and, you know, household expenses, everything.
Oh, I don't want to talk about it. It's just too depressing, honestly.
And the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have formally registered the birth of Prince George. They gave their occupations as Prince and Princess of the UK. That's the latest. I'm Anna Collinson.
BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. No Mark Weston, I'm afraid. We were expecting a little bit of a battle between Martin and Mark, as they usually do, but Mark had a business appointment which he forgot about. After the 6 o'clock news, despite the fact that it can contaminate the water table forever, and when they tried it in Blackpool and it caused earthquakes, the frackers are coming to Somerset. David Powell's here from Friends of the Earth to explain who's really behind this, whether there's been any real consultation, and whether there's good enough reasons to pursue such a potentially dangerous technology. Plus, Bradley Manning is guilty of exposing war crimes. Edward Snowden's guilty too of exposing mass surveillance of hundreds of millions of innocent people. That's us. From spying on Nazi military communications to spying on us, we take a look at our own spy agency, GCHQ, in Cheltenham and its origins in World War II. So where did they go so wrong? Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. Quite a lot this week. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs up to 23. Sunnier on Saturday, cloudier on Sunday, and a few light showers even possible on Sunday. Next week, highs of 23 Celsius, some heavy showers on Monday, but the rest of the week is sunny with a few light showers. Next weekend, that's the 10th and the 11th of August, highs of 20 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup. Hi, Derek, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
First of all, the youth services. There's a lot of discussion about the way that's all panning out. It was privatised about a year ago, and now that's all working its way through the system. And there was a big meeting in Southmead last night looking at the future of youth services. Now it's being privatised. What are your thoughts on the way things are going?
Well, I think right back in 2011, when this was announced and they first started consulting on it, we said that it was going to be an utter disaster, because they were talking about cutting the budget by 20% in year one and a further 20% in year two, which meant there was much less money going to go into the service. And that's what's been proved. They've had a much smaller budget to go around the city. We said that there was going to be closure of youth services right across the board, and we said we were going to have a much smaller provision, and that's what's happened.
Well, does it actually matter, money spent on these kind of youth clubs and this kind of thing? Because, I mean, young people are very good at finding their own entertainment and their own things to do, aren't they?
Oh, well, if you go and talk to young people will often say, when you talk to them in the holidays, I'm bored because there's nothing to do. And what adventure playgrounds, what youth clubs, what youth workers, outreach workers going out to young people is help find positive things and point them to positive activities. And in the end, pointing them to positive activities keeps them out of trouble, provides them with things to do, and in the end is much more cost effective than cutting youth budgets.
Now, I know you've got some interest in this yourself. Can you just explain that?
I work for one of the organisations that actually delivers part of the contract. And
so that's interesting, isn't it? Because you're saying on the one hand, your group, the Labour group, was against it, but you personally are actually involved with one of the groups that's taken over the contracts.
Yes, but I work for one of the agencies that's taken over part of the contract. In terms of my work, I'm not involved with the contract. My involvement has been looking at things like youth clubs and looking at their future and how we can keep them going as buildings.
Okay, so what do you actually do? I mean, you know, you're obviously doing some sort of strategic work. Who do you work for and what's your job?
I work for an organisation called Creative Youth Network. They work with young people mostly around the arts, but they also do an awful lot of youth work across the city and in South Gloucestershire.
But if you're taking over contracts from the council, surely you're happy about that? That's paying your wages.
No, because my organisation does a lot more. My work is looking at land and buildings that my organisation used to provide a whole range of different services. Part of that is to deliver the contract by the council.
Can you give us an example of some of the buildings that you're using, how you got hold of them, how you came across them and what you're doing with them?
Well, to give you an example, our core building is we own 29 acres of land in Kingswood, which was the former reform school, which was opened by Mary Carpenter.
So is that officially outside the Bristol boundary?
That's outside the Bristol boundary. And from there, we act as a centre to provide services to young people, as well as being the home for 23 other voluntary sector organisations, such as Barnardo's, Jessie May, all sorts of organisations, providing a very wide range of community activities.
OK, that's one building. What about something that's inside the Bristol area? Because that's what we're interested in here particularly,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, we also run the station, which is the old fire station in Broadmead, where we and other youth organisations provide a whole range of services to young people. So we have organisations like Brook Clinic, which are providing mostly sexual advice, health and sexual advice. We've got people like Young Bristol are based there, Basement Studio, the YMCA, Bristol City Council have got facilities there, Basement Studio. So there's a whole range of organisations as well as ourselves that provide services for young people. Now, part of what's done there is youth work for the City Council.
Okay, now I know a year or so ago the Lib Dem Gary Hopkins, he was trumpeting this as going to be actually wonderful to privatise this, because his argument at the time was we're going to actually be getting more for less. That's what they normally say when they privatise something, isn't it? More for less. So it's going to cost less and we're going to get more in the way of services. Now, what did he say, and what's actually transpired since?
Well, what Gary did say was that we were going to get an enhanced service, that we were going to get more youth work, and we were going to get a better quality of service. However, when you dramatically cut resources, and it's not only the amount of money that was going in, the money that you see, it was the money that was actually running the buildings that the youth work is carried out from. So, for example, my organisation, one of the things that they're trying to do at the moment is to offer youth clubs to the voluntary sector, because the council is saying we don't have the money to run them anymore, we don't have the money to maintain them. We took over one of the premises from the City Council 3 years ago. It was in such a poor state, we had to raise £250,000 to bring it back into a usable condition.
Okay, where did you raise that money from?
We raised it from grants and trusts. Everything from the lottery to small local trusts, CETA, you know, the landfill tax, a whole range of different places. Now, if you have 20 or 30 youth clubs across the city that all need investment, all chasing the same funds, you're not going to be able to find the money. And it's not only when you take over a youth club, if that youth club previously, because the club we took over was being used 2 nights a week, 3 hours a night. So it was being used 6 hours a week. If you're to make a building sustainable, you need to be using it 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you have got to make that building usable. You've got to make it multifunctional. You've got to make it used for more than just a youth centre. Now, to do that, you've got to bring the facilities up to scratch, and you've got to remodel it so you can deliver a variety of services from the same building, and that costs money. And at the moment, that money is not on the table.
Derek, the council, they get an income from us, they get some from the government, but they get a lot from council tax, from parking services, all sorts. They've got a guaranteed income. What about you as an organisation? Because obviously if you're going to be paying people, staff in these places, and you're going to be paying the electricity bills and maintaining these buildings, where are you going to get that money from in the long term?
Well, there's a big difference between a local authority and being a statutory service with the government behind you, so basically you can't go bankrupt, to a charity, which usually has very small amount of reserves, has to live year by year, and you can't afford to take losses. So when you take something on, you have to make it work. You have to make sure that income equals expenditure. Otherwise, you go under. And what we're starting to see now in Bristol and across the country is a lot of small neighbourhood charities are now closing.
What about more long-term, your organisation? Surely, you know, as charitable donations go down, I mean, we hear again and again that the charity funding pot is going down. You're just going to go down too, aren't you?
No, because I think you've got to look at the charitable sector. And some organisations are falling by the wayside, basically because the way funding's going at the moment, and a lot more money that's going into the charitable sector is going through by commissioning. So you have to be a larger charitable organisation to actually be able to bid for those contracts. And very small organisations are too small to do that and tend to get trodden on, if you like, by bigger organisations. So what's happening is those that are a bit, are somewhat bigger, are in a better position to compete for the resources that are there.
Okay, there was a meeting in Southmead last night. Any idea how that went?
Well, Southmead, what they're planning to do is to link up with the Southmead Trust, which runs things like the Greenway Centre. So by linking themselves to a larger organisation that already runs land and buildings, etc., they would hope to be sustainable.
Fingers crossed.
I think it's very much fingers crossed, and every youth club is not going to have that opportunity. And already we're starting to see some of the adventure playgrounds close across the city and some of the youth clubs. So if you look, for example, Windmill Hill City Farm, I think a well-loved project, they've already had to basically close down their adventure playground. Felix Road Adventure Playground, that's only part-time now, only run for a limited number of sessions a week.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, let's bring you in. I mean, normally we start by talking about some of this macroeconomic stuff, but can you explain how that is now filtering down into youth provision? I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate slightly with Derek there, saying, do the teenagers really need this kind of service? But ultimately, what is the benefit of having these youth centres continuing to be open?
Well, I think it's fairly clear what the benefit is. I mean, Derek's pointed out, I mean, the young people do need constructive things to do, and I mean, these adventure playgrounds, for example, have been there for years and are very well-loved institutions in the local community. I think the macroeconomics of this is we need to actually spend more money on these social projects, if you like, rather than less. And in actual fact, that would be the answer to a lot of problems. It would put people to work.
That's interesting, isn't it? That actually, from a macroeconomic point of view, it'd be great to spend money on these things. Yeah, well, I suppose the problem is it's very difficult to get that money.
They say there's no money, but
what about
there is.
What about the wider picture, though? Because these used to be the sort of stuff that our council tax or our rates used to pay for. Now, that's been now shoveled over into the charitable voluntary sector, which is falling to pieces. Parts of it are just simply going to the wall.
Well, I mean, we had Charlotte Leslie in here last week talking about the big society, which she was supposedly in charge of. I mean, the big society is all of these kind of projects and social interventions. And in actual fact, the charitable sector, the voluntary sector, is in crisis. I mean, as a result of funding.
Sorry to be so cynical, but isn't this deliberate? The government is shoveling all these important services that they used to provide as part of what the government did over onto a sector which is now collapsing. And then now the government doesn't take the blame. The charitable and the voluntary sector are taking the blame.
Well, look at the work programme. I mean, like Tomorrow's People, the sort of work programme provider that I've had dealings with, I mean, they are going to be bankrupted by the work programme because none of them are going to complete their targets. And it's all payment by results. So 90% plus of the people who've been on the work programme over the last 2 years did not find jobs. And so the organisations which bid for those contracts are going to be bankrupted. And Tomorrow's People have existed for 20 or 30 years as a reliable third sector organisation putting people into employment. They're going to be bankrupted. And this is what's ironic about David Cameron's big society, because what he's actually doing is destroying the voluntary sector.
Derek, can you just give us a sort of overall, someone that knows quite a bit about this whole sector, how are things changing over the last 3 or 4 years, and where do you see it in the next couple of years heading, the entire sector? I mean, I would guess we're talking about something like 20 youth centres across the city. How many in a couple of years' time?
I think the big problem is the amount of resources available.
Money.
To the charitable sector.
Money.
Mostly money. It's shrinking. And when you look at the other resources that the voluntary sector called upon, like people volunteering, if we actually look at changes in society, now in families, to make ends meet, everybody in the family tends to work. You know, one person isn't sitting at home. You know, if you're working to make ends meet, how can you then be volunteering? The amount of money is going down. With the amount of money going down, the voluntary sector is trying to be as effective as possible in how they use that money. The voluntary sector has always been quite business-minded, I think, in the way that it tends to use it, because of this thing that they can't afford to make losses, because otherwise they go under. And I think what we're going to see is that more locally-based charities that are quite small are going to lose out, and they're going to go by the wayside. Some of the larger charities, which are big enough to bid for government contracts, are probably going to stay around. And what's happening is the government, as you were saying, is using them to deliver more and more what we used to describe as statutory services. And if they go wrong, instead of saying, okay, it was our fault, they're going to say, no, the people we contracted to do it, it's their fault. They didn't get it right. They're passing the buck.
It's interesting, isn't it? Just about shifting the blame. Well, one of the big stories this week was to do with the NHS 111 service. And let's go, because, I mean, the House of Commons is in recess for the summer, but the House of Lords is not. And actually, one of the quite interesting things is you see some interesting debates coming out in the House of Lords when I listened to Today in Parliament that you might not necessarily hear from the House of Commons. And here it is, there's a little discussion on the NHS 111 service. The former Health Secretary for Labour, Lord Reid, and also he's now one of the spokespeople, I may even be a Health Minister, I think, from the Conservatives, Lord Howe. So let's have a listen to their little exchange and a discussion about the apparent failure of so much of this NHS 111 service, particularly NHS Direct deciding that they actually could not afford to run the thing this week.
The successor to NHS Direct 111 appears to be in turmoil, both practically and commercially. The deterioration in our accident emergency services is getting exponentially greater. Trolley weights are back and predicted to potentially reach a crisis point. And some Bruce Kiosk report, if read carefully, identifies as underpinning many of the problems in our major hospitals a chronic shortage of skills and finance. So can I ask him, please, not to accept this with any degree of complacency and introduce some scheme of forensic appraisal of 111 and some of the other issues which are arising from what looks increasingly like a costly, disastrous reorganisation of the NHS? Yeah.
I don't think anyone takes issue with the concept of 111. Unfortunately, however, we have seen in a few isolated cases problems arising. I emphasise that the vast majority of the country are receiving a good service. And incidentally, there is no evidence that attendances at A&E have been affected by 111, the rollout of 111. In fact, attendances have not increased since 111 was introduced. The figures have actually gone down. NHS England, I am confident, have taken these issues forward with the seriousness that they deserve, and I am assured that even in the areas where problems have arisen, the service is good.
That was at Lord Howe there at the end, speaking in the House of Lords this week about the 111 service. Derek, did you see dispatches on Monday? Because they had Bristol, one of the Bristol centres run by this private company, Harmony, who are supposed to be running the centre, doing things like taking clinical decisions without actually anybody who's clinically trained in the room from another untrained advisor.
No, I didn't see it, but it certainly doesn't surprise me. And I think one of the problems with statistics is it depends how you use them, and you can use them in different ways. And I think a lot of things that Lord Howe was saying aren't actually true. And my information is things like A&E have been having problems, that more and more people are going to use them. And the 111 service has caused all sorts of problems, you know, right across the country.
One of them there saying it was costly and disastrous, the other one that's saying that there were a few isolated problems. Martin, did you see the dispatches on Monday either?
I did not,
though. Oh dear. Sorry. Well, I did, and it was pretty, I mean, half of the programme really was about a Bristol 111 centre, and it was shambolic, to say the least. Not enough staff in there, and all sorts of really, you know, what was going on was hidden filming within the centre. With one of these dispatches people, and it doesn't seem, this is the fundamental problem here, is it doesn't seem that this idea of changing over from NHS Direct to this 111 service has gone through any kind of real testing, even though, of course, the thousands of people that will phone it, their lives are at stake.
Well, yes, and of course there's a tendency for new governments like the Coalition to change things for the sake of changing them. Do we remember what David Cameron said before he was elected? Read my lips, no top-down reorganisation of the NHS. So that's what he said.
Well,
and that's what he got voted on. He voted in on the back of that.
Derek,
of course, immediately they start.
Call me cynical, but isn't this actually just a part of discrediting the NHS in order to leave the way open for bigger changes?
Oh, I think I'm quite sure that Cameron would like to see huge changes in the NHS, and would like to see more of it privatised, and that we have a much smaller NHS. The government have made it very clear that they'd like to see government at both a national level and a local level reduced. They're much more focused on the individual, and the individual, if you like, paying for what they get. And I think we can see reductions across the board in terms of services that people receive. You can't take tens of millions out of somewhere like Bristol City Council on an annual basis and say that services will remain the same. At some stage, certainly at local government level, we're going to have to turn around central government and say, we don't even have sufficient resources to maintain statutory services. That's the way things are moving towards presently.
Well, you're talking about the law there and whether you can do statutory services. This week we heard that A&E services at Lewisham Hospital will stay. Jeremy Hunt has been overruled by the High Court, so I don't know who his legal advisers are up at the Department of Health, but he's broken the law. Plans to slash services at a successful London hospital have been declared unlawful in a blow to the Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt, which could have major repercussions for future NHS hospital shake-up. In an unexpected triumph for local campaigners, a High Court judge ruled that cuts at Lewisham Hospital approved by Mr Hunt earlier this year should never have been recommended in the first place. Lewisham Hospital was threatened when a neighbouring trust, South London Healthcare Trust, which was losing £1 million a week, was placed in administration. As part of plans to reconfigure local services, the administrator said Lewisham Hospital should make the cuts in its maternity and A&E services, despite the fact it operated as a separate trust and was performing well. Martin, what is going on here? There's the health secretary actually breaking the law. This is Jeremy Hunt, of course, who kind of hot-footed it from the Department of Culture, Media and Sport whilst trying to fix up certain deals for Rupert Murdoch and being discovered and his emails being outed. But he's still in government and he's now running the National Health Service. Not very well, it seems, according to the lawyers and the judges at the High Court.
Well, we're waiting for a major National Health Service institution to go bankrupt, because that's what will happen if, with this marketisation of provision, the idea of separate cost centres and all the rest of it. The logical corollary of that is that some of these things will go bankrupt. So your local hospital will go bankrupt and then you won't have one.
No, you will. It's just that it will be sold off to the private sector, surely.
No, because the point is that you will eventually reach a situation where individual trusts and so on will not be viable. Now, of course, the National Health Service was originally conceived as a national service planned at national level. So a lot of this stuff is actually, we're talking now about the silly decisions that were taken when Labour were in power, and before that when the Conservatives were in power. The idea of creating pseudo-markets, purchase of provider split and all the rest of it, which is actually just a recipe for bureaucratic mess-ups and entanglements. You know, you need to actually have a plan. But we've got this case hasn't been properly made for a generation. You need a national plan for things like national health services.
Well, I'm sure the Conservatives would say what you really need is a good market in health. And we've got another story this week. Privately run hospital taken over by the National Health Service after patient deaths following routine surgery. This is a privately run hospital taken over by the NHS. The Listus Surgery Centre, doesn't sound very, it trips off the tongue that, does it? Surgery Centre in Stevenage has been signed over to the local NHS Trust after the Care Quality Commission began the process of suspending its licence last month. Local MP Stephen McPartland said the unit had been bought by the government from Clinicentre Limited, part of British construction multinational Carillion, for a sum in excess of £54 million. There have been concerns over patient safety, Mr McPartland said. Confidence with it was so low that GPs were refusing to refer patients. At least three people died, 8,500 patient records were lost, and a whole host of serious failings led to the Care Quality Commission beginning proceedings to suspend Clinicentre Carillion's licence to operate at the surgery centre because of serious concerns for patient safety. I mean, this bothers me particularly because we've got Carillion at the centre of this massive PFI, Derek, in North Bristol up at Southmead, and it seems that part of the same company is losing patient records and, according to this report anyway, people dying unnecessarily on their premises.
Well, unlike Martin, I don't agree with the privatisation of statutory services, and the National Health Service is something that I think just about everybody at one time, well, everybody at one time or another has to rely on it. I know personally, you know, there's members of my family wouldn't be alive now if it hadn't been that we've got a National Health Service where we can call upon a service that's free at the point of delivery and is a service that is of a quality service that you can rely on. And that's what all of us want. It's a quality service that all of us can rely on. And I think we have to say we want a well-run service. I don't think we should say what we want is a well-run business. We want a well-run health service that's accessible to all of us and is provided free at the point of delivery. And it's about time the government took back control of the National Health Service and continued to break it up in putting it in the hands of a whole range of different providers, which, as you said, once you start doing that, you've got all sorts of issues about monitoring the quality of it, etc.
Mark Martin, the local MP, Mr McPartland, said that Carillion should never be allowed to manage another hospital facility in the UK. Oops, they are managing ours right now. And criticised the former Labour government for putting a building company in charge of a highly sensitive and complex surgical procedures. A representative for Carillion could not be reached for comment.
Well, it could be, but let's have Snurco G4S Eddie Stobart running it, eh?
I mean, the point being, this is Labour, right? This is the point, Martin. And I got both of you to answer this. What they're saying there is that the process by which this has now happened, this hospital failing and having to be retaken over by the government, bought actually off this company by the government, is actually a process which was started by the Labour Party.
Excuse me. Well, yes, I think, but when Labour were in power, they continued the philosophy of marketising the health service, which then makes it very difficult for us to oppose further marketisation by the Conservative Liberal coalition. And what we've had is a generation of nonsense, actually, a whole generation of nonsense.
What do you say to this, Derek? Labour Party. This is a train which has crashed, which was started off by the Labour Party.
I think it's about time all the political parties actually admit that they make mistakes. And when they make mistakes, that they learn from those mistakes and actually move on, rather than trying to stand there and say, no, it wasn't us. You know, it was okay at the time. I think they've got to say, right, we made a mistake. We've learned from that mistake. We move on. This is what we're going to do now.
So what are we going to do?
Well, I know what I'd do.
Go on then.
I'd be moving on. I'd be looking at a national health service that all of us can rely on, and move back, as Martin was saying, to a national service that's available to all of us, with a consistent service across the whole country, and not a service, for example, where, you know, if you live in one postcode, you can get a particular service. If you live in another postcode, you don't get it.
It's called reinventing the wheel, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I mean, we knew how to do this 40 years ago, and we've forgotten about it.
The Labour Party brought in the National Health Service. It's about time that they remembered that and lent their weight behind it. So
well, it's all very well you saying them. That's you. You're a Labour Party councillor.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, I'm talking about the Labour Party as a whole. I'm only one member, and hopefully, as a party, we will do that.
Now, just to, I mean, this is worrying, isn't it, after this failure over in Stevenage, that we've got a hospital up in North Bristol which is being run by Carillion, the same people. And I think, I'm not sure, is it in 10 years or so that they run it for before they hand it back to us? And so we've got 10 years to wait before Carillion are going to give this hospital back to us. And yet you've got the local MP there saying that the Carillion should never be allowed to manage another hospital facility in the UK.
Yeah, so you've either got to find a way of changing the contract, or you have to look again at the legislation, and if necessary, change it.
Yes, requisition the hospital off of Carillion so that nothing like Stevenage happens in North Bristol. Anyway, next story, Britain in debt. Half of UK adults are living on the financial edge. This is Heather Saul in The Independent today. Approximately 9 million more adults are increasingly struggling to manage their money now in comparison to 7 years ago, according to a major report into the nation's financial awareness. More than half, 52% of those surveyed, are living on the edge financially, equating to 26 million people across the UK, the Money Advice Service, the MAS, has found a sharp increase from 35% of people who were having difficulty maintaining household bill payments when similar research was carried out back in 2006. Derek, now this is the sharp end, isn't it? With the Mr. McCorber syndrome, where we were discussing this a few months ago, Martin, weren't we? Where he says if you've got a tiny amount less income than your outgoings, it's misery. All you need is a tiny bit more for things to sort of lighten up and everything to become relaxed. So he's saying effectively more than half people in Britain have got less income than their outgoings now.
Yeah, well, you've only got to look at some of the things that are happening. We've had the opening up of food banks all across Bristol. You can see that. You can see the consequences of things like the bedroom tax, which hits those on the lowest incomes. And everything you look at, all the cuts that the government are doing are hitting those at the bottom. So those at the bottom of the ladder that have the smallest incomes are those that are finding that their incomes are shrinking and that their money will not stretch anymore. And whereas if you're like Cameron, a multimillionaire, if your income goes down by 10%, your standard of living remains the same. If you can just about make ends meet and your income goes down by 10%, it's things like the amount of food, the quality of food, the quality of housing you have that's reduced. And I think that's what you're seeing by these statistics.
Martin, one quarter of the people surveyed said they prefer or they have to live for today rather than plan for tomorrow. The report also uncovered a concerning lack of financial knowledge. One in six adults unable to identify the correct balance on a bank statement. One in three did not understand the impact of inflation on their savings. Meanwhile, some 12% of people believe the Bank of England's base rate, which has been a historic 0.5% low for more than 4 years, was over 10%.
Well, that's possibly what they find when they go to borrow money. It's the Bank of England base rate is not what ordinary people have to borrow money at. I think the real problem across the Western world in the last generation has been that real wages have been stagnant. Real wages haven't risen in the United States since 1973. And of course, people then borrow money to keep up a standard of living. So people have to go. If you think about it, you know, you have to borrow money to go to university and study. You have to borrow money to buy a house. People have to go into debt just to survive. And people like my sister, who's in her nearly 50s, still haven't paid off her student debts from 30 years ago. And that's the real problem, is that capitalism has been based upon debt. And we're now paying the price for that.
The things like the bedroom tax, food banks, these are all they are all there. I mean, the food banks are helping, obviously, bedroom tax isn't. But it's like trying to gather tax off people who've got the least money in society doesn't really seem to make sense. Surely the idea of tax is it should be levied on people who've got larger than property portfolios, something like that, or else on luxuries to pay for the basic necessities.
Well, yes, I mean, we need to reboot the tax system. In the 1950s, when you had a conservative government in Britain under Macmillan and Eisenhower running the United States, the top rate of tax was 96% in both the US and Britain. It was. Yeah. It just was. And nobody moaned or groaned because people were dying in Korea to stop the communists from taking over, and everybody knew, if my son's going to go and die in Korea, you are going to pay 96% tax. And that was how it was.
Now, if you're thinking what I'm thinking about million-pound bonuses and million-pound salaries for bankers, we've had quite a lot of reporting this week, haven't we, from some of the major banks, Barclays, RBS and Lloyds. We'll start with RBS today. They've appointed Ross McEwan, apparently, as the successor to Stephen Hester, and they're announcing profits of $1.4 billion. Well, the two stories which are kind of connected are the Lloyds and the RBS one, really. Both of them now saying, hurrah, hurrah, we're back in surplus. RBS in surplus by $1.4 billion. Lloyds by... I'm not exactly sure. I'll tell you that figure in a minute. But anyway, both of them back in surplus. And now talking about the possibility, Martin, of selling these off on the stock market again and then becoming private companies. So the government, hopefully, will get our money back for bailing them out.
Yeah, I think all of the banks, frankly, are still zombie banks. All of them are not marking to market what they've got on their books. So they're all sitting on masses of paper assets, which are supposedly worth blah, which in actual fact aren't worth blah. And that they've been allowed to mark onto their asset sheets these things at the price they paid for them when they originally bought these derivative contracts, whatever they are. And in actual fact, if you go through it properly, a lot of it is just not there. And in actual fact, the profits aren't really there. So in other words, the profits, what they're doing, in fact, is if they were running a private company like a pizza stand or whatever, what they'd be doing is illegal. They actually, when they say they're making profits, that means that the shareholders can be paid off, the bonuses can be paid out because we're making a profit, but that's because we're not really going through the books properly.
Derek, $2.1 billion it is, Lloyd's profit, we hear this week, and RBS, $1.4 billion. They're now making money, they're now ready to be floated on the stock exchange again, and it looks like we're going to get our money back.
Well, that'd be interesting to see if we do. However, I don't know that... the government have been in there long enough to withdraw. I think we need to know a bit more about the long-term direction of travel. And as Martin was saying, one of the big problems about companies and banks is that often you have assets that are valued. When there's a slump, they don't revalue those assets, so that on paper they still sound as if they are a business that's viable. We've seen in the past property companies where the property market has gone through the floor, they have not revalued their assets. The banks have kept them going on the basis that hopefully the economy will reflate, the assets will go back up, and they won't lose any money. So whether we're in that situation at the moment, who's to tell? But I don't think we're seeing the economy getting back on track. You've only got to look at somewhere like Bristol City Council, where the mayor's announced that he anticipates that over the next 2 years they will basically sack another 1,000 people, and that's going to happen right across the country. So where is this boost in the economy that they keep telling us that we're getting? So I think at the moment we still have to look very carefully at the banks to see whether in fact we have got over that hump or not.
I wonder, Martin, do you think we've dealt with the problem in 2008? One of those big problems was that all these financial, big four financial services firms that do the audits for these banks had actually got it all wrong, hadn't they? And what makes us think now that these figures, the 2.1 for Lloyds and 1.4 billion for RBS, that these financial services firms are now squeaky clean, honest? This is people like Deloitte and KPMG, and that these are good figures?
Well, they're not. I mean, basically, the financial system is in a terrible, terrible state. And people are in denial about it because they don't want it to be true. Everybody would like it to be nicer than it is.
But
the reality
sure
is there's a massive bubble.
One thing's for sure bubble is that actually property prices are maintaining, aren't they? For example, house prices. Okay, they're not going up at the rate that they were 10 years ago, but they are just about managing to make a little bit of an increase. So people, you would expect if there was a real serious problem with these valuations, that property prices for homes and businesses, offices, these kinds of things, would be slowly going down.
Well, no, because you've got quantitative easing going on and base rates down at 0.5%, which basically means negative interest rates when you take into account inflation. And even with all of that, all we're managing to do is just keep the asset bubble afloat.
So are you saying that if any of these assets were actually sold on the open market, they wouldn't be worth what it says on the balance sheet?
Well, the most significant thing that's happened in recent weeks is when Ben Bernanke in the US, who's the head of the Federal Reserve, suggested that they might taper off quantitative easing, and there was an immediate kind of meltdown in the stock markets across the world. And of course he then said, no, we're not going to taper off on quantitative easing. So in other words, the financial sector globally is completely addicted to quantitative easing, and any attempt to remove quantitative easing will lead to an immediate crash. But of course eventually the central bankers are going to lose control of the situation, and there is going to be a crash, and it'll make 2008 look like a walk in the park. And when it happens, I don't want to turn around to the Labour leadership, for example Ed Balls or whatever, and say, oh, who could have predicted that? I'm predicting it right now. And when it happens, I want the civil service to have a plan B. Plan B for a crash. And I don't want to hear, whoever's in government, when that crash comes, that the civil service haven't got a plan. Don't want to hear it.
Well, there's another bit of a spook in the upstairs room of RBS and Lloyds, and that is the potential money that they may have to still pay out on the payment protection insurance, what they so annoyingly try and call mis-selling, which is actually fraud. You heard it here. It's fraud. And the other thing, of course, is the interest weights. Swaps. They were also missold, in inverted commas, fraudulently sold. And then there's the LIBOR scandal. So none of these have actually worked their way right the way through the system, and there may be massive liabilities on these banks for these various frauds.
Well, the Detroit is about to go into bankruptcy, and they're going to not pay the pensions of people who used to be employed by the city government there. But the banks are going to get paid 100% of all the money that they lent on these swaps to the Detroit City Council. So in other words, this is the bankers are eating off Detroit as we speak. And actually what I'd say is the banks shouldn't be paid anything, and they should be wound up, basically.
Well, RBS has set aside some money for this. On the PPI, they've said they've put aside another extra $185 million in their balance sheet to deal with that. And 385 million has been put aside for legal and regulatory costs as it faces a raft of ongoing litigation cases and investigations, including for ongoing action in the US related to LIBOR.
Yes, but see, the LIBOR fraud, basically, it's not a victimless crime. It's basically big municipalities like Detroit in the US have lost billions on LIBOR fraud, and that's why they're bankrupt.
So, well, we shall see if these are successful banks, and certainly advice from this programme is don't buy the shares if they do get floated on the stock exchange. Blue chip hackers may be named and shamed after the serious organised crime agency chief resigned this week. This is Britain's organised crime fighting agencies under intense pressure to release the names of 100 blue chip firms and individuals, two major celebrities apparently, who use rogue investigators to steal information and commit crimes after the sudden resignation of its chairman. Sir Ian Andrews stepped down from the Serious Organised Crime Agency after failing to disclose he owns a consultancy with his wife Moira, who works for a leading international investigations firm. Derek, Serious Organised Crime Agency, are they part of Serious Organised Crime themselves? At least maybe not anymore now this chap's resigned.
Well, he certainly wouldn't expect that somebody who heads an agency like that was working as a consultant on the side. I don't think it's a surprise to any of us to hear that companies, particularly the blue chip ones who are likely to have more resources anyway, are resorting to using private detectives to get information and
steal information.
Well, steal information.
I mean, they're doing two things. They're doing, one is paying officials within government agencies such as the police to get information, steal information from the police national computer, or alter information on the police computers, delete information on computers, and then they're also doing this blagging thing, which is where they phone up pretending to be one person. Yep. And get people's things like people's passwords, people's personal details for their bank accounts.
I mean, I'm not surprised, because you know, computers, the internet, online information, it's still something that's quite new, and I still think we've got a long way to go before, if you like, information becomes secure. It's certainly not secure at this point in time.
I mean, how can this guy get away with having a directorship of another company which is involved in this private investigation, which he hasn't actually declared, even though he's the boss of the Serious Organised Crime Agency?
I find it unbelievable that something like that should be allowed to happen.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's look at the NSA, the stuff about Snowden that's been coming out. I mean, basically, you've got to realise that if you're doing anything online or with a phone, it's absolutely hackable.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, well, fair enough. The Serious Organised Crime Agency Chief Sir Ian Andrews, who quit this week. Unbelievable. I don't know who's going to take over from him. We shall see. But, I mean, if he's got some sort of interest in private investigations, that may be, well, maybe his firm is on that list. Maybe that's one of the reasons he doesn't want to release it to Keith Vaz at the Home Affairs Select Committee. Who knows? Government bee scientist behind a controversial study joins a pesticide firm. This is the revolving door story. Dr. Helen Thompson's study was frequently cited by ministers arguing against a ban on neonicotinoids. A key government scientist whose research was used by ministers to argue against a ban on those pesticides thought to harm bees is to join Syngenta, the chemical giant which manufactures one of the insecticides. This is the same old story, Derek. We're seeing government people who are writing reports which are actually exonerating these big companies then going into work for these big companies. Syngenta, in this case, we also do genetic engineering.
Well, the problem is, I think today you keep getting the government and moving into bed more with the private sector, and you're seeing a lot more people from government moving between the two, between private sector and government, and I don't think it's at all helpful that if you want to monitor and you want to have some distance between the two, everything's become very blurred these days. So as you say, you can have a person writing a report on one side of the fence, and the next week they're the person who's rebutting that on the other side of the fence.
Well, now she's working for Syngenta. I wonder if she was having cosy cups of tea with whoever it was that wrote the report for the Department of Agriculture saying that genetically modified food was safe for us to eat, Martin.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a revolving door syndrome, as you say. I mean, ultimately, I mean, we ought to have a civil service which is a career civil service. and you don't, in fact, bring people in from the private sector or second people from the civil service to the private sector. That used to be, we're talking about the 1940s, that was an understood principle. Yeah, yeah. It was a well-understood principle.
Yeah. One of the other examples of this, of course, is to do with psychological warfare and the strategic communications industry. People who are trained by the army to do psychological warfare, they'll sit and work in as an officer doing whatever it is in Libya, you know, putting out broadcasts or taking out Gaddafi's transmitters or whatever it is these people do, and then they get a tap on the shoulder. They say, would you like to get paid 10 times more than you got in the army and come and work for us, maybe Bell Pottinger or somebody like that?
Yeah, well, also Homeland Security in the US, which didn't exist before 2001, now employs a million people. There's a million people who work for Homeland Security.
Derek,
what do they do?
Seem that the private sector are kind of using government almost to do the training for people. Then once those people who are in the government do a little favour for those private companies, then they just step out of the government and into the private sector.
But you've got a government at the moment that believe far more in the private sector than they believe in government. So I think they would see that the logic that the private sector and government should be working together more. So I think it's just a consequence of the sort of government you've got at this point in time.
It was also true, though, that PFI, for example, was pushed through by Labour, under Labour. There's been a whole generation of silliness about this, and we've got to put our hands up and say that Labour Party went down this road as well, didn't we?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. PFI was one of the most horrendous things that the Labour government ever used, and I cannot understand the logic of why they went down that.
Because it meant that they didn't have to put stuff on the books as government debt. It's because when an NHS trust borrows money from the private sector, that doesn't count as government debt.
But that's called account trickery, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's just silly, really. It's the most expensive way to do it.
It's very silly, because there were lots more other ways that were put forward by members of the Labour Party to the leadership of the Labour Party in terms of other ways that you could pay for it.
Some might say false accounting, which is a criminal offence. I couldn't possibly comment. Anyway, the Lords again. We'll go back to the House of Lords, the Palace of Westminster. I quite enjoy it when there's no Commons and the Lords are just chatting.
They're much quieter, aren't they?
But they also tease out some fascinating points. And here is the Lords Communications Committee this week. And you're here from Daniel Elstein, who used to work for Sky, and he's discussing how the BBC might be able to have a bit more of a diverse news output, because he's obviously not very happy with what's going on in places like Newsnight, where you seem to have been discussing Twitter almost all week this week, discussions about things that don't really matter with people that don't know anything about them. So here's his solution to what the BBC should be doing with their news output.
I would love to see Tony Hall taking the principled view that the way to deliver internal plurality is to reverse the process that he has played such a large part in, which is allow BBC Radio to be independent editorially, allow the BBC News Channel to be independent editorially, allow BBC World Service to be independent editorially, and allow BBC Online to be independent editorially. Obviously, they all end up reporting to the Director General, because that's the nature of the beast. But you shouldn't have, and in my view, long ago we shouldn't have had, this mammoth editorial bureaucracy trying to tease out what can and can't be said across the entire range of BBC output.
Now, is that something you would agree with, Derek?
I think something like the BBC ought to be independent of politics.
But what he's saying is that whether there should be lots of different editorial views within the BBC, or whether, as now, there should be one single view which goes through television, radio, world service, and everything. I mean, surely that smacks to me anyway of control freakery. You want to push these decisions about what's important and what isn't editorially out, surely.
I think it's if you try and have a national view on every single item, you've got to have a huge bureaucracy to make that work. And I think in this day and age, things should work much more at a local level.
I think the real problem is what the Sky chap in the House of Lords there is saying is, why can't we have more Fox News, for example? Why should the BBC is regarded by the right wing as liberal bias, because it actually covers all the ground. What they want is, what they actually want to see is the BBC turned into Fleet Street. So we've got a Daily Mail over here, a Daily Mail programme over here, a Daily Telegraph programme over here, and whatever. But the BBC, in actual fact, does cover a variety of views. There isn't just one view. They're statutorily imparted, you know, they're supposed to actually cover, they don't cover all views, but they do actually cover the majority of the most views that are current in the society. But I mean, if you look at Fox News in the US, that is literally propaganda newsreel. Is that what we want? I don't think it is.
Well, what about this idea he's talking about there, which is to allow much more independence for the different bodies? So the idea that the BBC has an editorial line makes it too bureaucratic right across the corporation.
But the editorial line of
the website. Why can't the website, for example, have a separate view to what BBC News is saying?
Well, the editorial line of the BBC is to make sure that all views are covered. And that doesn't happen in Fleet Street or on Fox News, does it?
What's causing this, Derek, really, is a concentration of media into fewer and fewer hands, isn't it? I mean, we've got many of our local newspapers around here, for example, have closed down, including the one in Clevedon, etc. I mean, they may have some sort of presence still on the internet, but we are seeing fewer and fewer people controlling what we see and hear.
But, I mean, I think Martin's right that... if you think about the BBC, and when you listen to the radio, the television, you listen to the news on the BBC, you take it as more or less as fact. If you listen to some of the American channels, like Fox News, it sounds more like a fairy tale when you compare it. It certainly doesn't sound like fact. It's more like fiction. So we do need to have something that we can rely on and is believable. And at the moment, the BBC is something that we all feel, for the most part, is reliable and we can believe in.
Okay, on to a final story, a local one. It's so difficult to get things done in Bristol, says Steve Lansdowne. Bristol City owner Stephen Lansdowne has spoken out over how difficult it is to get things done in the city. In fact, it was David Garmston, I think, from BBC Points West that had a nice little trip over to Guernsey and an audience with the great man himself. The co-founder of successful stockbrokers Hargreaves Lansdowne hit out at the red tape and endless procedures which frustrated business people. He said the city has a reputation of being a graveyard of ambition. He's obviously talking about, amongst other things, his stadium at Ashton Vale, Martin.
Well, yes. I mean, these people think they've got a right to tell us how to run the city because they've got loads of money and they're obviously so successful and they know what they're talking about, so we've got to listen to them, eh?
Well, he's told the Bristol Post it's always so difficult to get things done in Bristol. I've always believed Bristol's been very successful in spite of itself, but it's very, very frustrating when somebody like myself and Peter Hargreaves go to the council and come up against what seems to be a brick wall of endless procedures which thwart you.
Yes, there's all sorts of thwarting to be done there, isn't there, really? I mean, the Hargreaves Lansdowne, if the state hadn't stepped into the market in 2008 and bailed the market out, Hargreaves Lansdowne would probably be bankrupt like many of the other hedge funds. So these people basically have survived because the state stepped in and bailed them out. They're very arrogant.
Okay, that's all for now. Murdoch News at 6 time now. Thanks to this week's guest, that was Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup. After the news, it's fracking.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a couple who left a 4-year-old boy alone to die after subjecting him to months of abuse have each been jailed for at least 30 years. The judge condemned Magdalena Wuschak and Marius Krezalek for their campaign of brutality against Daniel Pelker. A serious case review will take place to establish...